it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History.
Win.
We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Oi, oi, I'm Jimmy Bullard, and this is me old muck of Fenners. We're back together, son. How are ya?
Hi, Bully. Great to be back working with you. Well, what are we doing here, though?
We're starting a football club in podcast form. The only thing we know, it's called FC Bullard. After that, it's all up for grabs.
So, we haven't got any players, we haven't got a kit, we haven't got a club badge, we haven't got a stadium.
Correct. FC Bullard. Welcome to the club.
Why are we doing this?
For the love of the game, mate.
For the love of rugby.
Let me introduce your hosts.
How good is the French crowd, though? Playing away in France is extremely difficult.
No man has played for England more times than Ben Youngs.
Do you want me to give you the translation?
Oh, Dan Cole. With his 100 caps, all his medals, his cuddly cute face and his beautifully shiny head.
Arise, children of the fatherland. The day of glory has arrived. Against us stands tyranny. A bloody standard has been raised. Do you hear in the countryside the roar of these ferocious soldiers? They come right into your arms to tear the throats of your sons, your wives, for the love of rugby. In today's episode, your complete guide to France.
Another incredible anthem.
Dodgy French food.
And another to a Langy.
Enjoy.
Hello, Ben.
Coley. How are you, mate?
Bonjour, Ben.
Bonjour. I did that on purpose.
Yeah. Bonjour, ça va?
Oui, ça va.
Conseil comme ça?
Ce n'est pas le confortable pour moi.
Je habite une maison et j'ai un chien noir. I'm doing my GCSE French here if you don't know.
Right, enough of that bollocks. Coley, we're back, mate. Guide to France. People have been loving these episodes with our little insights. And it's in Lyon.
Yeah, different. I hope the traffic's going to be good. I think this year the French have taken it all on tour, moved away from Paris. I think Lyon was used in the World Cup. England didn't play there, but I think Wales played there and New Zealand played a few games there. So it's, you know, it'd be exciting.
They've moved around a little bit, haven't they? Obviously Marseille, then Lille, yeah. And now Lyon.
Yes.
And they've lost all of them. So I'm hoping that obviously that England go there and do the job.
That would be nice, Ben. But obviously the French, they are very... Historically, the French can run hot and cold and they can be rubbish and then they can turn it up, especially against England and the phenomenal players they've got, the size, the speed, the power they've got, they can turn it on. And if they do turn it on, they're quite hard to stop.
Le crunch. Coley, as always, you got some facts, have you not?
I've done some research on the history of French rugby. It's quite interesting, but I'm going to keep it short, right? The British actually invented the game and brought the game across to France in the early 1870s. And then in 1905 was the first time England and France played in what we now know as the Le Crunch. 1910 was when the Five Nations was coined.
Is that when it was?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
In 1920, the Olympics, France lost 8-0. They bottled it in the final. Do you know who they bottled it against?
No, I don't.
The USA. And the USA won it again in 1924, which meant the last time it was played at the Olympics. So they are the reigning Olympic rugby champions.
So USA, so big shout out to all our listeners in the USA.
Yeah.
You are reigning champions.
Yeah.
Wow.
I found out this quite interesting. In 1932, the French were kicked out of the Five Nations for, apparently they were paying their players, so professionalism, and player violence, which again, sometimes if you've ever played in France, you'll understand that because they're not adverse to filling you in, basically.
Well, they're not bothered too much about towing the law.
But there is a dark side, because in World War II, right, before that, rugby league was getting a really big foothold in like the 1930s. Rugby league was getting a big foothold and taking away union. And after the Nazi invasion in France, there was a puppet government put in place in the bottom of France called the Vichy government. And they thought that rugby league was for like communists, whereas rugby union upheld the values of like Frenchness and like Nazism. So basically, they confiscated all the rugby league stuff and gave it to the union teams. And they've never given it back.
Absolutely mental.
So they've never given it back. So apparently that's why rugby unions are really strong in like the south of France, because it was basically promoted as like this French game. And the rugby league is basically just recovering now. But that's why. And that's my history of the French rugby. So yeah.
That is very insightful, Coley.
I found that interesting, like the World War II bit. It's like,
that's
a bit naughty, but you know, it's the French.
Let's talk about the traffic out there, because it would be remiss of us not to mention the amazing police escorts that we get out there.
Yeah.
Or that you'll get.
Hopefully. Yes, the World Cup last year, we had an amazing security team. England turned up, and do you remember where we trained in Latuke? There must have been, was it like 30 gendarmes, weren't there, who were like just police, armed police? But then we had a specialist team of 8 security guards who were drivers everywhere. Brilliant guys. We mentioned them before on the pod. Aimed with guns up to the eyeballs with different guns and that kind of stuff, but they were not shy about moving traffic out of the way. And hopefully a few of them might be at the game this weekend. It'd be nice to see them. But it just makes me laugh, because England turned up with its security team, who I know listens to the pod, both of them between 65 and 70 years of age.
I
think the French are deemed as like a high threat for a terrorist. Like, potentially, if one team's going to get a terrorist threat, it's going to be England. So, you know, England will come well prepared with security. And our two blokes turn up, and then the French are there with like semi-machine guns, whatever it is. And like, they're like, where's your security team?
The Chuckle Brothers. You're telling me that the French were underwhelmed with our security team?
There may have been, but the French had it covered. And I say, hopefully, there might be a few of those boys the game this weekend. And it'd be great to see them, because they looked after us properly in the 2K and for the rest of the tournament, and it'd be nice to see him.
My understanding was, after the World Cup and how good the French security does, that Bruno was going to take the job of the two current Chuckle Brothers, and
to put context,
they were going
to
have an early retirement.
Bruno was one of the security guards, or one of the policemen, not security guards, mate. He was a policeman, and I think it was his final, basically, tour. I think he'd been on tour for like 25 years, every year going away to like Syria or Afghanistan, or as part of the French police. They're a bit different over there with the gendarmes, who are like military police and they're boring people. But, I think he was then going to go to a civilian life of being head of security somewhere, but we were trying to get him into the RFU. So that hasn't happened yet.
Well, the Chuckle Brothers know they're on for such a good thing that they don't do anything. So therefore, they're not going to let that go from their hands. Can you remember 2016 on our way to the Grand Slam game? Talking of, like, and we're on the bus getting the escort.
Yeah.
And we're on the way to Stade de France.
And there's a tight bend, wasn't there?
Tight bend, and there's a chap that had collapsed.
Yeah.
Don't worry. He was fine. He survived, and everything was fine.
We think.
But he was basically laying there, sprawled out, like, in the recovery position, and with the bus couldn't get around. Can you remember?
There was a lady with him as well, like, trying to be like, he's all right, get the bus around, but then trying to move him. It's like, do you want us to help you? And it's like, we can't really help you. We don't know. Like, it was an awkward situation.
Really awkward. It's like on the bus, it's like, how long do I look for before I, she keeps looking at me like, it's fine. Yeah. And we're like, but is it? And then we couldn't get around. And then it was like, you know, Austin Powers when he's moving the vehicle.
Yeah.
And he's like going back and forth. We eventually got around, but didn't matter that day. So Lyon is the stadium.
Yes.
I've never played there. Have you played there?
No, I've never been to Lyon. I did some like a little bit of research though, as you'd be glad to know, for people that are going there. But apparently it's France's second most wealthiest city. That's the research for you. Thanks very much. I did some Googling. I mainly did the stadium, because I was more interested in what the Groupama Stadium.
What's the capacity?
The capacity, Ben, is 59,186. And the record attendance was Montpellier versus Lyon in the top 14. But it's also, you'd be glad to know, it had games from the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, the UEFA Euro 2016, the 2023 World Cup, and concerts. Mate, Will.i.am opened it. You had Rihanna play there, Coldplay play there, Celine Dion, Ed Sheeran, Phil Collins. You've also had Muse, Red Hot Chili Peppers. Taylor Swift is going there this June, and then Coldplay after that. So it's obviously a great stadium.
Well, I look forward to hearing all about it. I tell you what, the talking of obviously, I'm assuming that there'll be plenty of English supports going out there or driving there. And we better give Chris Robshaw a big shout out, because he, if you see him on a bike, Coley, explain what the situation is on this.
Robbo agreed to cycle from originally London to Paris, which is about 300 miles.
Because he thought the game was
in Paris, France, as you would. Then he found out that it was in Lyon, which is another 300 miles further on.
So if you are listening to the pod and you pass Chris Robshaw on a bike on the road to Lyon, be sure to give him a hoot, because he'll need some encouragement.
600 miles on a bike.
Oh, my ass.
Yeah, for a great cause, but should we got some Vaseline, because that's going to hurt. So yeah, Lyon, apparently it's also the cuisine capital of France. I found this out. I was looking for sort of like what would make it the cuisine capital of France, and I found out that they have a thing called a French taco, which is a fast food dish containing a tortilla grilled filling of French fries, cheese, and meat. It's similar to a burrito, but it's from France. So
it's basically a combination of a lot that they've just put their name to.
So you think of all this like French food that they eat, and it's basically the capital of French cuisine. The best dish is a taco.
How good is the French crowd, though?
Oh, they are I reckon...
Well, they're best and worst, depending on how you play it.
But I think as a spectator, if you're a neutral, going to a rugby game in France, you've got to do it. Especially, like, I remember when we first started playing in France, like, going to places like Perpignan and Clermont-Auvergne, like, phenomenal atmospheres. Like, the fact that the fans come out, literally turn off the bus and the stadiums are almost like semi-full. There's drums banging, banners being thrown off. Like, and when you actually get going, like, it's no reason the French teams are like undefeated at home, because there's 20,000 people or 15,000 people there just screaming their heads off. And I think, you know, they inspire their team.
They make it into like a carnival feel, don't they? Right. And it's because you're right. Like the away games in France, and this is just at club level. Like, the atmosphere is class, as you say. Like, it's a real vibrant, like, you can just, the whole community's out. Like, the whole city, town, whatever, it's like, it's a big part of their weekend. It is the part of the weekend. Yeah.
Like, have you got any favourite memories of, say, we'll start with, like, club rugby in France and then international rugby in France?
We beat Montpellier away, didn't we, with Leicester?
Yeah.
And Conover scored right at the end. That was a great, memorable day. Perpignan, we would have been young going to Perpignan. I think that was when Carter had signed for them.
Yeah, we played them like 2 years in a row in Europe.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if I started one game and we were getting absolutely battered in the scrum. And it was like 40 minutes up. We had 10 minutes of scrums on our own goal line. They had a man, they were down to 14. We had 15. We basically scrummed for 10 minutes. The hookers both got yellow carded. So then we had 14, they had 13. We brought Matt Smith at number eight into our scrum. He reckons it's the hardest thing he's ever done on a rugby field. At one point, he reckons it was Marcus Yerza, was basically bent in two by Nicola Mass, and he was making eye contact with Smith through the scrum. And Smith's like, I don't think that's properly, should be going on. Another time, he's that knackered, he got up, and then Lewis Deacon, our second row, told him just to fucking push and shut up. So he was doing that. But then, we held out for like 10 minutes on our goal line, and then somehow they ended up passing it wide and having an overlap and scoring. And that was at the other end of the field, and like the changing rooms were literally 100 meters. So not only had we done 10 minutes of scrums, we had to trudge off, and it was like the longest. You know, when like you just want to get off, and it's like the longest trudge. And I got substituted straight away.
So that's Perpignan. They call it the bear pit. Do they call it the bear pit?
Yeah, because they kind of like
cage all around the rim. That's a great place to play.
Oh yeah,
we haven't played there for years though.
Well, Perpignan, they kind of fell down the league a bit, didn't they?
And, yeah.
But that was, they were in their pomp then.
Toulon.
Yeah.
Great place to play as well.
Yeah.
Terrible pitch, but great place to play.
Oh yeah, and we played, do you remember playing that European, was it a quarter final?
Yeah.
When they literally had like Sheridan, Heyman, Backes Bota, Juan Smit, Wilkinson played.
Lobe.
It was like the superstars, like Bastereau, it was like the superstars team, wasn't it? It was, that's what I say, when you think about French rugby, you think like just really good teams and like playing in some superstars.
I think, having said, like, all those stadiums are brilliant, but I do not think you can ever, like, to really enjoy playing in France, Clermont away.
Yeah.
The Stade Michel Michelin is unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. That's what I remember growing up, like, as a kid, watching, like, not a kid, but I was, like, probably when I was 19, 20, I remember we played an academy game over there and watched the first team, and it was, like, unbelievable. And just having played there, like, I don't think there's much else to do. Clermont's quite secluded, I think, in, like, the mountain ranges. That's what we got told anyway. And there's, like, the Michelin factory there, but literally it shuts down for the weekend and everyone comes out for the rugby, and it's one of the best, loudest, most passionate places you'll play, and it's brilliant. And I say the stadium's brilliant, and it's, yeah, the support they get in France is unbelievable.
That's the type of, like, Clermont away is the type of game that when I'm finished, like, Clermont is a game that I would like, if someone invited me to go, oh, do you want to come, you know, come to Clermont for a weekend and go watch them, and, you know, this is a European game, whatever, I would absolutely go, just because to actually experience it as a player was amazing. And I think when you're a fan, you have that carnival atmosphere, pre-game, post-game and all that. I think you're in for a great day, sorry. And I think that's like the French playing away in France is extremely difficult because of what is sort of created from the fan base.
Definitely. I think that feeds into it. They say they're passionate. I think referees probably panic that their cars are going to get smashed in if they give any dodgy decisions. And then, you know, they are. And also, sometimes in France, they're a bit of a commute to get to. It's not like just down the road. Like, France is a big place, and, like, you turn up there, the home crowd, the home team. And often, I think French teams almost target the home game. Traditionally, they target the home games and want to win them. And the away games, they're not too bothered about because they know everything goes against you. But, yeah, I've got some of the best games I think I've been involved in or spectated have been in France.
One of your early games for England, and I remember it because I'd only played the week before and I was on the bench. I didn't get on, and you started. And we played France away at the Stade de France, and they won the Grand Slam that year.
Yeah.
2010.
Yes. No, that was the final game. I think we lost it like 15-9 or something like that.
It was tight.
I'm pretty sure they scored all their points from scrums. We absolutely got battered that day. And yeah, I thought that was like the beginning and end of my England career. And yeah, but seeing that, the only good thing to come out of losing that game was getting to watch the celebrations afterwards, because they know how to celebrate. I'll give them that, with the fireworks and the crowds involved, and the place is just buzzing. And you're kind of like, if you're going to lose anywhere, France is not a bad one to.
I remember we lost, they won the Grand Slam in 2022, and we lost in the Stade de France. And the atmosphere after, they had like lasers and fireworks going off, and the music was blaring. And I remember just standing on, like, literally on the edge of the pitch with Sam Underhill, and obviously you're gutted and stuff. But I said I remember just sort of standing with Sam Underhill and just thinking, like, I tell you what, like, this is pretty epic. Like, sort of witnessing the excitement, the atmosphere, that party feeling. Like, Stanford say, it was electric that night. You know, they won the Grand Slam, and actually, it was, although you lost, it was kind of like, it was like a memorable moment to be a part of, I suppose, that, to witness that sort of excitement and energy within the air. You could just feel it. And after they'd won and the noise and at the fire, it's like, it was electric. And I remember just standing there with Unders, and I was sort of just taking it all in, really, just thinking, like, Christ, like, this is pretty epic.
Yeah. If we move on to, like, the current side, obviously I'm not going to talk too much, but they've obviously had a slightly slower start to the tournament. Obviously, the past year, they've gone into the World Cup basically being favourites. France obviously lost a heartbreaker against Africa in that quarterfinal, where, in some regards, France probably should have won. And, you know, you look at the tries that Africa scored, they almost came off French mistakes rather than South African dominance in some regards. And then they've had a sort of slow start to the tournament this time round, obviously losing to Ireland, beating Scotland, but then, I mean, they're down to 14 against Italy, but they're there. What do you think, or why do you think that is? Do you reckon it's a World Cup hangover? Do you reckon it's just you lose Dupont? Is Dupont that bigger player to them that it's that leadership and all that kind of stuff? Or do you have any theories on this?
It's difficult. It's really difficult because, you know, I don't know the French psyche that well, but I know that, you know, they have reputations of being flaky, or, you know, maybe, let's say, don't mind a revolt, or suddenly, like, if things don't go well, they can all sort of be a little bit stubborn. But I don't actually know that. That's just, like, you hear that they can be a certain way. But if you look at it, right, they won the Grand Slam in 2022. They just lost out on 2023. Ireland obviously won it. And they had a great game between Ireland at the Aviva that year. So then they're leading into the World Cup. And they were the favourites for the tournament, without doubt. They then beat New Zealand round one. Like, it's all set up for them to go and almost win it. They play South Africa. And as you mentioned, when you actually look at that game, it's a fantastic game of rugby. But they don't field a cross kick. Bounces. Delandy picks it up. Like, a few phases later, try. They don't field another cross kick. Same thing happens. And then they've got the ball and it comes a loose pass. Cyril Bai tries to like flick it on the floor. South Africa pick it up, pass, Cheslin Kolbe score. So like, grubber kick, score. And so you look at it and you're thinking like, oh my God, like we've lost, yet we kind of, not imploded, but like, because they didn't implode, but like, it's an awful feeling of like we like shot ourselves in the foot here, like massively. And I think that takes some serious psychological to get over, because everything was set up for them to go win it. They're at home. It would have been the most amazing, incredible thing. And the only thing I can relate to is obviously 2015 when we had a home World Cup. Now, we weren't going into that as favourites. We weren't. But had we gone into that as favourites, then got a little bit and then sort of almost bummed out with it being your own, for your own downfalls at times. And obviously Ramos got charged down from a kick. You don't know if he'd have got it or not anyway, but you know, that stuff doesn't happen. Like two cross fields you don't feel doesn't happen. A prop that, you know, just dive on it. Instead he tries to flick it. And I just think that psychologically that would have dented them so much. And now they've lost a couple of games. Obviously they scraped past Scotland. And I just look at them and I think, I just wonder what's going on there. Dupont is so important to them. And I think they've definitely miss that guy that can pull rabbits out of the hat, can almost invite people into the game, can find Penno in wide channels with his distribution, coming down short sides and finding him, bring others in the game, be a threat himself. And I don't know, they just look a little bit lost. It's like they kind of, they've still got the hangover of the heartbreak.
Yeah, well, so I think sometimes with international rugby, there's such breaks in between the tournaments that sometimes coaches, well, as a player, you go back and play straight away, you know, play next week or 2 weeks later and you're back on the sort of horse. Whereas coaches don't have the opportunity. So sometimes I think they can sit there, there's a lot of media pressure, interest. And I'm not going to say coaches overthink things, but they can sometimes go away from what's made them really good. And you think, I've got to evolve, got to do this, got to change. And I'm not saying it, but it can dilute what makes you good in the first place. And sometimes I think you need to, there are times when you have to get some defeats in some regards. So go back to your core principles of like, this is how we are. Actually, really good side. We've got really good players. Play to our strengths. So I don't know if that's happened in the French team, but it kind of, you could potentially see it being a reason where, you know what I mean? After the World Cup, such an emotional loss that it lingers and you try and think, well, we won't have that again. And it negatively affects you in, you almost try to play against what makes you the strongest team, but you kind of go away from, you think, oh, what we did before wasn't good enough, so let's change. We're actually freak events in that game basically disguise what, or make you think differently about what was actually the problem.
100%, because if it's not broke, don't fix it. Because for the last 3 years, they've been really dominant, like really dominant. And that one incident, that one game, three isolated moments where on another day, they catch the cross kicks. On another day, like Cyril Bai jumps on that ball, it doesn't bobble. They don't go hands and grubber it in. Cheslin scores. Like, you're right, mate. Like, you then go searching for, like, I've got to change this and that. And actually, what you were doing was more than enough. And actually, you can just layer on what that already is. Obviously, in 2015, when we did lose, we then had a whole new coaching staff come in. So it was almost like it helped almost park, not park, but helped. You know, the coaches weren't still hung over from it and they weren't still angry about it. That it was a fresh coaching staff that were like, right, this is how England play. This is what we're going to do. And although you were still hurting, they didn't have that emotional attachment to it. And you wonder whether Galtier and all these guys have still got that emotional attachment of almost like, oh, like what could have been?
Yeah, I agree. Totally.
Mate, it's obviously Dupont who is out doing his seven stuff, right? But like, what a special athlete to be at, because people think that any 15s player could just go and play sevens, right? They can't. It doesn't work like that. Like, for him to just play 15s, obviously do the World Cup, go play for Toulouse, and now he's off doing the sevens, like, that is a special, like, athlete to go in, because it is a different game. It is.
Yeah, well, as a sevens specialist myself, Ben.
Have you ever played in a sevens tournament?
Yeah, when I was like 16, 17.
Don't worry, we're going to Hong Kong, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. True that.
And we've got the Dubai tens.
I once pulled my hamstring playing sevens at school, and Cockers then banned me from, I don't remember my wrist as well, but like banned me from going anywhere near the sevens field. So that was that. That was the end of my fledgling sevens career. But no, definitely. I think like originally, probably back when we, but when we started back in our day, like 10 years ago, whatever it was, sevens, it was 15s. So there weren't, sevens is a specialist game now. I think the way that sevens has gone with, especially being the Olympics, being the World Series that they kind of have, it's so specialist that it's become its own almost unique sport. Whereas once upon a time, there was crossover in, you know, wingers, winger and scrum half can do this. Like sevens is now the fitness needed, the skill set needed is almost separate from rugby. The fitness, I mean, it's 7 minutes each way, but you're flat out for the entire time. Whereas in rugby, I think the longest ball in play passage is about 3 minutes, and then you have a break, and then you have a minute, and so on and so forth. So we've got the Olympics this year. There's no men's GB team. There's a women's team, and I think they're going to smash it. But the men's team, there's not one. But let's make one. At the home unions.
Yeah, let's make one.
So we can pick Scottish, Welsh, and English players. Who's your sevens team?
Right, so we're only having English players. No, I'm obviously kidding. Well, I'm not. I am. We can't have Lewis Rees-Sammet because he's obviously gone. So he's not available. So I'd have Darcy Graham would be in there, the Scottish winger.
Yeah.
He's injured at the moment, but he is like very, very jinky. Duane van der Merwe. He's got, right, let's start props. Duane van der Merwe, one prop.
Yeah, but you're a winger, are you? I'm thinking like the front row, you just want blokes that are going to, it's going to be your back rowers that are just going to run around and hit things.
I'm still putting Duane van der Merwe as a prop.
Are you? Okay. And we need line option. So we need maybe a back row that's got a bit of height.
Right. So hooker. Who are we playing hooker? Back row's got to be a hooker. Who are we going? We need people with engines here.
That's what I mean. Like you're looking at your Tom Currys of this world, like one of the Curry brothers, Underhill.
Tommy Raphael. Hamish Watson? I know he hasn't played.
Can we have three back rowers?
Yeah. Okay, fine. I'll give in. We're three back rowers for the front row. Go.
Okay. We're going to have Raphael because he's our friend.
So he's at hooker.
Yeah, and then we'll have Curry. I'll say Curry because it could be Tom or Ben because we just
can't tell the difference. No one will know. We can like run them on.
Because those blokes are incredibly fit. And then we'll pick a Scottish back rower. Ooh, it's a tough one.
I'd go Hamish Watson. I think he'd be pretty effective at sevens. I'm not going to budge on Watson. I'm having Watson.
All right, okay, fine. Right,
fine, yeah. Thank you. Right, scrum half. We are going to go with Alex Mitchell, I'd say. I think he'd be a good sevens player.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think which other. Ben White would be. Ben White's got a good engine on him.
Yeah.
Like a bit sport. Thomas Williams, actually, as well. Scrum half's a hard one. Who are you picking?
Well, you're the expert, mate.
I am. You're right. I'm going to go for scrum half in the sevens. I'm going to go for. I think I'll go with Alex Mitchell. I think I'll go Mitch. Mitch at nine.
Okay. Fly half?
See, everything says Russell, right?
Yeah.
But I just don't think he's got the capacity for sevens in terms of. I think he'll blow out. Like.
Possibly.
So. I don't think he...
I think it's about Marcus Smith.
Oh, how did I forget? Marcus is definitely...
His ability, his one-on-one, his catch pass, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, he's our fly-off. So we need two more.
Then I'm going to have Duane van der Merwe on the wing.
Yep.
And in the centre, I'm going to have Darcy Graham. We'll stick him in, like, jinky, busy. He's injured at the moment, but he'd make it. So yeah, we'll get that team together. We'll make sure that GP are represented at the Olympics. So just pick those seven. We'll roll them out every week.
Right, let's roll to the ads.
That was your adverts. Coley, the anthem. It's another cracker.
It's probably the best one.
I think it's a great one as well.
It's best one, Ben, I'd say. Do you want me to give you the translation?
Yeah.
Well, basically, you got to remember, it basically comes from, it was the French Revolution where they got rid of the monarchy. I've read all about this, mate. I've read a book on Napoleon, so we can spend hours discussing this. But it was sung in Paris by volunteers from Marseille, so that's why it's called like the Marseillaise. But anyway, I'll give you the English translation. Arise, children of the fatherland. The day of glory has arrived. Against us stands tyranny. Her bloody standard has been raised. He said that twice. Do you hear in the countryside the roar of these ferocious soldiers? They come right into your arms to tear the throats of your sons, your wives.
It's pretty dark.
Yeah. To arm, citizens, form your battalions. Let's march, let's march. So that an impure blood waters our furrows. So that an impure blood waters our furrows. Basically, I think they want to kill everyone that's in charge and...
cause some damage.
Yeah. So that's probably why they're all fired up.
Given the World Cup scandal of kids singing it, do you reckon they'll do that in Lyon?
I hope not.
I hope you can appreciate the
French. Honestly, that was one of my main disappointments of the World Cup was like the opening night, New Zealand, France, and it was like, this is going to rock all of France, the anthem. And then it was kind of like, it wasn't the kids singing, but it was almost like an echo effect. And it was rubbish.
It was terrible.
It was rubbish.
It was shocking. And like, you're right. Like that anthem is so good. Opening night, New Zealand, Friday night, start the World Cup. Here we go. And only in the way the French could.
Yeah.
Blew it.
Yeah.
Absolutely blew it. And yeah, that, thank God, you know, they saw the light and they changed it early in the tournament. Cause that was a, if you're in the stands there, right, and you brought your ticket, that's one of the things you're looking forward to, right?
Yeah.
You'd be like, this anthem, like the energy and the atmosphere is going to be amazing. And it's just, what? Who's that? Who's singing that? Yeah. Like, where are the kids? What's
going on? You kind of expected it to get going. It never did. And you were just like, oh.
Oh, it's finished.
Yeah. So.
You got many French shirts? You swapped many? Great kits.
Yeah, like, no, I haven't. A couple I've swapped, but like, no, not many at all, which is a shame because I know the French, they say it's the classic. They do. I don't think there's ever been a bad French kit.
No, it's a good kit. Yeah. It's a great kit. They look slick taking the pitch.
Even the big boys look. And they got some big boys. Like, they look good.
They are massive. What's why is that? Like, why, you know, France is traditionally like their pack is huge. Like, do you reckon some of that comes because their league is different and becomes more of a bit of a slog fest, so therefore you need big men, and because they are ginormous, the French pack.
Yeah. Oh no, I think like the French definitely have a, like the way I look at the French, especially the forward pack, instead of like English rugby, we have like beam pole second row. We have second rows basically for lineouts. Whereas I think French rugby, they have second rows to push in the scrum, because I think the scrum is a massive part of their game. And it's almost like the back rowers then become the lineout forwards. So, and yeah, I think the tradition of the French game is built around the scrum, and they have ginormous people, and they find ginormous people to play in the front rows and the front five. And that kind of feeds off. And I think because you've got such big blokes that win collisions, that then feeds into the rest of the team, be able to run around and play in that Gaelic flair that people talk about.
You know, when you're obviously scrummaging, and the difference between, because France, compared to a lot of other teams, they love to have a huge lock, right? And we'll touch on one in a second. But they love, a lot of teams don't have that luxury of having one massive lock, right? But equally, a lot of teams wouldn't roll the dice and necessarily put one in. So they'd have two line out forwards in the second row. Where France tend to have line out forwards in the back row, a line out lock, and then just one massive body. And like, what difference can that make to the scrum? Because they love a scrum.
Yeah, it makes a massive difference. I think like, especially when you have a second row that's job, almost they know is to push in the scrum and go around and hit things. And like that kind of enforcer, which they've traditionally had. I remember playing France where like Pascal Pape and Lionel Nallet, and before that, Palouse and stuff. It's like, there's almost like iconic figures of French rugby, these big men that are the enforcer types that go around and push. And I think like, especially scrum time, they make a massive difference because quite a lot of packs are balanced out. But if you have a second round that weighs 130 kilos or something like that versus a guy that's 15 kilos, 20 kilos less, it makes a massive difference. And I think, you know, in the English game, we try and get the best of both worlds, and you try and get big men, big athletic men, like we've got with, say, Marrow and Chesham and George Martin. But sometimes, I mean, it's brilliant, but it's, if you've got a guy that weighs 130 kilos, but he can weigh 130 kilos plus because he doesn't have to jump in the line out. You know, it's ending an attitude scrum. They almost know that because I'm not in the line out, I have to push hard in the scrum. It makes a massive difference.
It's almost like that is their role.
That's their job.
And actually South Africa, although obviously their front row is formidable, they also have a luxury of massive second rows that add a huge amount of weight.
Yeah. Oh man. And then in the game, when all this is equal, like it is a, you know, size wins. Mass moves mass, as the saying goes.
And talking of size, 19-year-old Posolo Tuolangi son of Henry Tuolangi, the biggest man in the world. He's actually taller if he lays on his side. He's that wide. He's like a brick. He's a cube. He's a human cube. He's 149 kilos, apparently. I love how he's just snuck under the 150 mark. He's obviously doing the Matt Stevens way in there. How many Tuolangis have we played with, Coley? Can we work it out? And why is it that they're so good and massive? Like, that is, it's phenomenal, really.
Yeah. Well, obviously, they have some very good genetics. I remember Henry was just, he's one of the most powerful men I've ever seen on a rugby field, played with, like, just big. Like, there was 1 year, he ended up breaking his leg, but he was best player in the Premiership by, it was probably before we sort of played, so it must have been 2005, 2006 area, and he was phenomenal. But then, yes, the Tuolangis have the gene pool, brilliant, but we've played with,
Alassana. I don't
play with Freddie, but
I never played with Freddie.
I played with Henry.
Same.
Alassana. Then we had, obviously, Manu. Then we also played
with Vi,
and we played
Andy
with Andy, and then we have played. I'm pretty sure I played with Freddie Jr.
Yep, played Freddie Jr.
And Brian, who's also Freddie's son. I don't think I've played with him in the academy, so we've played seven Tuolangis there, and this weekend, hopefully, get to play against Nath. I say hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, you're not that keen to play against him. I mean, he's massive, right? Like, Jesus Christ. And like at 19, like, you know, what he is at 19 isn't going to be what he is at 25. So I think he's going to be in that pack for a long time, I'm sure, and mature and get better and all those bits. Because at 19, you probably, and you're 149 kilos, give or take, you probably don't know how to best utilize your weight, your strength and all that. You're still learning the men's game, aren't you? Like, you kind of, it's all new to him.
Yeah. The thing is, like, you watch him play and he's massive, but at the same time, he can move. You know, he's not like, and he's got that athleticism to be able to move, and fair play, you know, he was starting for France, and like, if someone's thinking, oh, is he a power player to come off the bench? But no, he starts and he goes like 50, 60 minutes and he's moving around, he's active, he's hitting things. And as you say, as he gets older, you probably find being in the professional setup and you end up putting on more muscle, you know what I mean? Like, it might be, his weight might stay the same, but obviously we weren't the finished Arsenal at 19, but he ends up putting on muscle mass and the body fat comes down, and yeah, he's going to be even scarier.
Well, I agree, because at 19, you know, he's not where he will be, but I like his subtlety. He can pass, he can tip, there's more to his game than just being a massive bloke, which is a slightly frightening prospect, really.
Yeah, and so he's Manu's nephew. Have you got any nephews in the gene pool that are 149 kilos and 6'5" plus?
No.
Just the Tuolangis.
I might get to 149 once I retire. That's the closest I'm coming to the Tuolangi gene. Incredible rugby family, really. Like, the amount of, I suppose, moments that they've given fans as a family, like, amazing, amazing.
Oh yeah.
They're good value for if you want a drink.
Well, I remember one time.
And Henry's very scary.
Yeah. I remember one time when I was about 19 years old, being a club in Leicester, I came out and I can't remember who I was with, but my mate was basically getting started on by four or five guys. So I was like, right, let's get out of the way. And then I sort of pulled him away and started walking down the street, and these guys were following us. And so then we started scampering away and they kept following us. Then we came around the corner and Alassana Tuolangi was around the corner and he saw me and I was like, Alassana, not help, help, help. But Alassana, he's like, what's wrong? I was like, these blokes are tracers, are going to beat us up. They came around the corner, saw him, shat their pants and fucked off.
I'm not surprised.
I was like, you know, is it Beethoven where it's like, you got the dog behind him. The kid's like, yeah, I'm freaking well hard. That was me. And it's like, Alassana's just there like.
Big Al, yeah. Mate. What? To be fair, out of all the Tuolangis I played with, Alassana for me was the best. Like, I'm going to put it out there. Big Al was.
He was on his day.
He was unbelievable.
There was that period. It was really weird because I remember playing the second team game, and then apparently, like, he played well, but he was nothing. But that, after that, he went on this streak, and it was away at Worcester. I remember it because he came off the field, stood on a Stickham can, with his stud pierced it, and Stickham went like exploded, went everywhere.
My eyes.
Yeah, he just laughed. It was like, oh, fair enough. But you know, that year, like, even to us afterwards, he was unplayable because he had Adrian. It's like in the Leicester gym, he was 124 kilos, but he has the I think he was for years the fastest player of 10 meters.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he had the quickest 10 meter power time for no one could beat it.
And again, the subtleties to his game. Like there were times when I remember him sort of almost three blokes hitting him into touch, and he'd just be able to like give a little offload. Boy on top, and especially when you had him and Manu in that Leicester back line, it was teams didn't want to pass the edge because someone was getting killed.
Yeah,
and it was
Nick Abendanon for Bath. I mean, if you've got a spare 10 minutes, just type in Nick Abendanon versus Leicester and watch the two Alangis go after him. And actually all the Polynesian lads. Oh. Because basically, Bath had ran a move the year before and Alisson had hit Abendanon off the ball and he got cited for it. And it meant he missed the Premiership final.
But I think Abendanon cited him because I think the miscycling commissioner missed it, but like Bath basically flew up and said, reported it, which you can do. And he missed the Premiership final, didn't he?
And he wasn't happy about this. So the next time he got to play against Nick, it was like an agreement between all the Polynesian lads that when Nick Abendanon gets the ball, you literally kill him. You decapitate him.
Fair play. He kept getting back up, Abendanon. I'll give him that. But yeah, he took a pound in that day.
Yeah. No, and actually, big respect to him because you're right. He kept getting up and coming up for more. But it's worth a YouTube visit if you want to kind of see that because there's a bit of context behind that. And then one thing I say is, I remember training one time and you know the old classic where there's like a line of pads and you draw and pass right. Anyway, so I'm going through, you know, pass. I get the ball and Henry's the next guy with the jackal shield and he ran at me. Honestly, mate, like I swear to God, like. I shat myself and I literally popped it away and he stopped and he just like bobbed me on the head like a little ruffle and he went, don't worry Lenny. I was like, oh my God. Coley, good luck to you and the England team in Lyon this weekend. I really hope to finish the Six Nations with a victory in La Crunch. Go well, mate, and I look forward to catching up when you're back.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Ben. Another episode done. If you want to drop us a line, get involved with our socials. Just search for @loveofrugby.
For the Love of Rugby is ad-free on Amazon Music. If you listen to Apple, you can get it ad-free for £1 a week.
And if you've listened to all our episodes and need another podcast, go and find Joe Marler's Things People Do.
Thank you and see you next time.
Sports Social Podcast Network.